The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. Coming up on the show, how are developments in neuroscience and technology reshaping how we understand our brains? And how do our brains construct our own subjective reality? In his new book, neuroscientist David Eagleman guides us through the world of sports, criminal justice, sensory expansion, and even robotics. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. David Eagleman is an assistant professor of neuroscience at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, where he directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action, as well as the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. He's written numerous books on neuroscience, along with the international fiction bestseller, Some. His new book, The Brain, The Story of You, has just been published, and David joins me now in the studio. David, you've published many books and academic articles on the brain. What's different about this book?
So what I wanted to accomplish in this book was taking the neuroscience and using it as a foundation for something that I think we all care about, which is self-exploration, knowing thyself. So the subtitle of the book is The Story of You. I'm really trying to use neuroscience as a lens so that we can better know ourselves.
But it seems that that's a bit of a problem, actually. When you talk about know thyself, it seems almost from the book as though ourselves are actually this rather shadowy concept, and we're in fact not so much in control of our own actions and ideas as we perhaps at first think.
So this is the first step to knowing thyself, is to figuring out how do our brains construct reality? How do we construct our own identity as we move through the world? Can we assume that memory is a thread that links us through time? You know, how do we make decisions? How much of what we do is happening under the hood of conscious awareness? These are the things that need to get aligned with what we know in modern science in order to have a good approach at understanding ourselves.
So one of the things that you talk about is the idea that we are live-wired, not hardwired. That seems to come back to the idea of the plasticity of the brain. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So your brain is constantly rewriting its own circuitry. Every experience you have, every conversation, these change the detailed microscopic impressions that are happening in your brain. And so we're constantly works in progress.
You talked there a bit about how we have to kind of understand this idea of ourselves and what we are and how our brains have developed to create this perception of ourselves. What are the key areas of brain science that are helping us to understand this idea? What's the current research that's going on to help us understand this idea of ourselves?
Well, what I'm doing in this book is drawing from essentially every aspect of neuroscience, from things happening at the molecular level when we talk about genetics and how much influence that has on our lives, to what's happening with modern technologies like brain imaging, to patient cases and what happens when we see brain damage and what we can learn from there. So I'm trying to hit it from all different angles, asking these questions about, okay, how do we actually move through the world and why do we believe the things we believe? And how can we become better decision makers? And what happens when you get billions of human brains together building civilizations? What does that lead to? And where are we going as a species? So to answer these questions, I have to try to illuminate these faces from many different angles.
In the book, you give a lot of examples of how we're influenced by numerous unconscious biases. So you talk about how whether or not a judge has had lunch might influence their decision. You know, you talk about the suggestion that our perceptions and attitudes, how we feel about things, can be influenced by something as simple as whether or not we're holding a hot drink. How much can we trust our own reason and judgment?
Well, for the most part, our reason and our judgments have come about because it's evolutionarily useful. The key is that we don't always have access to why we're doing what we're doing. As an example, in my last book, Incognito, I wrote a lot about judgments of beauty and attraction. And it turns out that often we don't have access to why we're attracted to some people more than others, but it's all for reasons that are running under the hood. When it comes to things like you'll judge somebody's being warmer if you're holding a warm cup of coffee, that has to do with this issue that the brain has the same circuitry that it uses for judging physical warmth and interpersonal warmth. It doesn't have separate things to judge those, and so there's a lot of crosstalk with those judgments.
Does simply knowing about some of these effects mean that we can sort of out-trick our brains, or would we be susceptible to them even if we know about these biases, even if we know about how our brains are processing information?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we're still just as stuck with the biases, and the people who benefit from it are people who are trying to sell you something. So, for example, stores will try to sit you in comfortable chairs and give you a warm drink and things like this because that changes the way that people make decisions.
So there's no way to get around this problem, but we can just feel good that at least we know about it.
That's right. I mean, a little bit of self-knowledge, actually. I guess you'd be able to see if somebody is doing that to you.
You talk a lot about, particularly in your last book as well, you mention a lot about this idea of how much, as you've said before, is going on under the hood, how much of this is happening in our subconscious. That's sort of generated quite a lot of debate and conversation. Not everyone is so happy with that idea. I mean, do you find that a sort of alarming notion, or do you find it liberating in some way?
In some sense, it's liberating because the amount that's happening under the hood is the type of thing that we would not be able to comprehend or do much with. I think a good analogy is if you have the CEO of a huge company with 100,000 people in it, the CEO doesn't actually want to know all the detailed machinery of the company because he or she couldn't possibly understand that all at once. Instead, the CEO has the job of taking the long view and trusting the operations of the company below. And that's essentially what our conscious minds are like. There's lots of stuff happening, and we only get alerted consciously when something goes wrong, when something violates our expectations. But, you know, if a CEO of a company were to try to go into everybody's cubicle and update the software and make sure they've got the right post-it notes and so on, the whole company would fall apart.
In terms of what this means for our perception of reality, though, this whole notion, I mean, what actually is reality if we all have this very subconscious thing going on and we're also locked inside our own sort of minds like this?
Yeah. I mean, the question of reality is can be a really troubling one, because reality, as I argue in the book and the companion television series, each of our realities is happening in the closed theater of our skulls. And what that means is that for every person, there's a somewhat different reality happening, because it's built from your genetics mixed with every bit of environmental experience you've ever had. And so how you interpret things, how you see things, this is going to be something that's unique to you. If we looked at the detailed structure of your brain, it's like a fingerprint. And the experience of being you and conscious in this moment is unique, presumably, in the history of humankind. So lately, I've come to be sort of fond of saying that it may be that we're each the sole inhabitant of our inner cosmos. It's like this movie, The Martian, where Mark Watney gets abandoned on Mars and he's got the whole planet to himself. Lately, I've been thinking, gosh, that's really what our reality is like inside our heads. We're each our own Mark Watney on our own planet. Now, language is a low bandwidth communication channel, and so we're all from our individual planets sort of giving these low bandwidth signals to one another, and that seems to be sufficient to get by, and we have things like literature and shared stories, so there are some little bridges between the planets, but fundamentally we're all like snowflakes on the inside.
I mean, societal interactions also have a huge impact on our brains as well. So, I mean, presumably we're not quite as isolated as that perhaps sounds.
Well, the thing is this, half of you is other people. So the society that you happen to drop into has enormous influence on who you become. And what I deal with in the chapter on social neuroscience called Do I Need You? Is this issue that it's hard to even demarcate where you end and other people begin, because it's all sort of a connected web. And when you look at the accomplishments of our species, it really can be viewed sort of as the accomplishments of a single mega organism. We're all so tightly tied to one another. So that crafts and shapes who you are. But when you're alone in a room and thinking about things and your next idea and perceiving the world, that comes out of the shaping that you've been subject to.
You also mention in the book that our memories are also pretty fallible. There are instances of research that you mentioned there where people have been able to sort of implant false memories in people, and they sort of become quite convinced that these things happen to them. What does this mean in terms of us as a society, in terms of law and order and all these sorts of things that rely on memory and on our ability to tap into our past.
Yeah. Well, you know, memory is not what we think it is. The difficulty in the legal system is that it's actually very hard to convince jurors of this sort of issue. So you can train jurors on this, and then when you quiz them afterwards, they'll say, okay, fine, but my memory is like a video camera. So it's really difficult to convince people to question how they remember things. But the Supreme Court in the United States recently came to a decision where they said, essentially, in so many words, they said, we're not going to put eyewitness testimony out of the courts. You are not constitutionally guaranteed reliable testimony from somebody. Because even though it's completely clear that eyewitness testimony can be really terrible much of the time, the courts realize that the system depends so heavily on it, because in many cases, that's all you have. You don't have a video camera or other sort of physical evidence. So unfortunately, we rely on it a lot. But it should be taken with a grain of salt.
You're also, as we mentioned earlier, the director of the Initiative of Neuroscience and the Law. How much do the two fields go together? It's obviously something that you feel quite strongly about.
It is. I've devoted a big part of my career towards this idea of how can we take neuroscience and improve social policy. In my country, the United States, we have the highest incarceration rate in the world. We put a higher percentage of our population behind bars than anywhere else. This is not only inhumane, but it's also very cost ineffective, and it doesn't solve the problem. In fact, putting all those people in prison causes more crime, provably. So the problem comes down to that we imagine that incarceration is the one-size-fits-all solution. But in fact, what we know from the neuroscience angle is that brains are extremely different. Along any axis that you measure brains, you find that they're very different, whether that's in terms of empathy, aggression, impulse control, whatever it is. So if you're a judge, you might have a bunch of people in front of your bench who've all committed exactly the same crime, but for very different reasons. This guy's got schizophrenia. This guy over here is a sociopath. This guy over here is tweaked out on drugs and so on. And what that suggests is we should have a more tailored, forward-looking system of justice where we root people appropriately forward through the system instead of imagining that they should all get exactly the same punishment.
Is that something which you're finding resistance towards people taking up? And presumably it'd be costly to develop that. But are people seeing the fact that that could be, you know, quite a beneficial way to tackle this?
The really good news I have to report is that people are taking this up, not because of the great philosophy behind the arguments, but because it's actually quite cost effective. So what's happening in the United States all over now is from the main court system, counties are peeling off a mental health court that just sees people with mental health problems, because that makes up now 30% of the prison population. So the judges and lawyers there have expertise. Then you have a separate drug court that gets peeled off so that people have expertise in what are the rehabilitative strategies that are available. These things actually save a lot of money. That's why counties are doing it.
There's another moment in the book where you talk about sort of how repeatedly practicing a technique basically means that, you know, you sort of change the brain in some ways, that you can carry out tasks on autopilot. Does this mean that we should be sort of less impressed when a footballer makes a great shot? How should we react to that?
I mean, I'm more impressed by it because what it represents is the thousands of hours of practice that his conscious mind had to put him through over and over and over until something becomes totally automatized, because it's quite difficult to become expert in some motor task like that.
Do we have a sense of how long or how much practice you need before something will become automatic? Or is that just...
People often throw around this number, 10,000 hours, somewhere in that ballpark, maybe, you know, plus or minus 8,000. But yeah, it's hard to quantify it, but it takes a lot of practice on a continuing basis to become really expert at something. And musicians know this, sports figures know this, it takes a lot of dedication. The interesting part is once you've automatized something, you lose conscious access to how you do it. So with riding a bicycle, when you're first learning how to do it, you're having to pay a lot of attention. But once you've learned how to do it, you would not be able to describe. It becomes ineffable how you're actually pulling it off.
So what does that mean in terms of trying to think about something? If you actually tried to think about it, you would then want to screw it up. You wouldn't be able to do it.
Exactly right. So here's an example. So for all the listeners, if you can imagine driving down the road and you want to make a lane change one lane over to the right. So how would you do it? Try putting your hands on your steering wheel and making the lane change. What most people do is they will move their wheel to the right and then back to center. But that's not a lane change. That actually steers you onto the sidewalk and then you crash into a building. The way that you do a lane change is you go to the right, then back to the center, just as far to the left, and back to center again. That's what a lane change looks like, but you don't even know how you do it. We pretty much lose access to all of the things that become automatized. And when we try to pay too much attention to them, like if a piano player pays attention to what his fingers are doing, he's dead. He can't do it anymore.
Your book obviously focuses, given its title is The Brain, focuses mainly on the brain. But you accept, you talk about the fact that other parts of the body also influence our behaviour and our personalities and all sorts. Are we wrong to try to understand the human body sort of organ by organ? Should we look, take a more sort of holistic view? Should we look at how they all interact?
Yeah, it's a great question. The brain is indeed tied into the entire rest of the body in big ways with the immune system, with the endocrine system, with signals coming up from the states of your different organs and your gut. It's all one big system that works together. Now, the reason we often concentrate on the brain is because that seems to be the densest representation of you, your identity, your personality, your hopes and dreams, and so on. And the reason we know that is because you can get your heart replaced. You can get lots of organs replaced. You can lose a leg and get a prosthetic leg. And that doesn't change who you are. I mean, it might make you sad about that. But if you lose even a tiny chunk of brain tissue, that can change your personality in a major way. So that's why those 3 pounds of tissue have something special about them. I think it would be, I'm making this up on the fly, but you know, if we asked about trying to understand England and the culture and so on, you might look at London as a hub of that, but obviously it depends on lots of commerce and traffic with every place, out, even way, way out in the countryside.
We were talking about the plasticity of the brain and the fact that it can make new connections throughout your life. It seems like this is something which has been gathering more and more interest in the field of neuroscience. What's the cutting edge? What's the questions that are being answered by neuroscience right now that the most interesting in your opinion?
To my mind, the most interesting bit is how quickly changes in the brain can take place. So as an example, we all know that when somebody goes blind, the part of their brain in the back that we used to call the visual cortex gets taken over by other areas of hearing and touch and vocabulary and other things take over that real estate because nothing lies fallow in the brain. But to my mind, the most interesting bit is how quickly it happens. If you go into the lab and we blindfold you and then put you in the scanner, it turns out after 90 minutes, we can start seeing activity in your visual cortex when we touch your arm or play a sound in your ear. So it's a system that seems to be poised right on the edge of change all the time. And it's sort of listening to the world to figure out how it wants to allocate its real estate to get the biggest bang for its buck.
You also talk about the idea of sensory expansion. So this kind of idea of, well, you've developed a sort of vibrating vest as sort of a manifestation of this. Is this sort of about creating an augmented experience of our world? Can you talk me through what you mean by this sort of sensory expansion?
The scoop is that we pick up only a very tiny sliver of the information that's out there. So what we call visible light is about a 10 trillionth of the light signals that are out there. All the rest of it, radio waves and gamma waves and cell phone conversations and so on, is passing through your body because we don't have specialized biological receptors for it. So we're only picking up on a little bit of what's going on. Same thing in the hearing range and so on. The view that I've come to recently is that really the right way to think about the brain is as a general purpose computing device. And all of these peripherals that we have, like eyes and ears and nose and so on, are just plug and play peripherals. And we could, if this theory is right, be plugging in any sort of peripheral devices and our brain would come to figure out the patterns and what it can do with those. So in my lab, we developed this vest, as you mentioned. It's covered with little vibratory motors like the kind in your cell phone that buzz. And we can pass any kind of data stream into people's brains through patterns that they're feeling on their torso. And what we're discovering is that people's brains are quite able to figure out how to make correlations with the patterns coming in and things in the world.
So what you're saying is that they're essentially, these things will buzz and your brain will be going, oh, that, yeah, by experience, will be going, oh, that means that something's coming towards me, or that means something
right.
like that.
So an example is what we're doing right now is curing deafness by taking a totally deaf person, putting the vest on, and then we capture sound in a cell phone, and then the cell phone sends the patterns via Bluetooth to the vest. So as their sound in the world, like my voice, the vest is going bzz, 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 with these different patterns, and a deaf person by reading my lips can come to figure out what the vibrations mean, what the patterns mean. It takes several weeks, but after 5 days, you can already see they're getting pretty good at it, and after several weeks, they're really good at it.
And so you foresee a future where this isn't just used for medical devices, but also used just to mean that we can see infrared and hear, I don't know, dolphins, or I don't know what the applications would be, but something like that.
Well, what we're doing is we're building an API, essentially a socket, so that you can plug in any kind of data stream. So we're experimenting right now with stock market data, real time from the net, weather data from the surrounding 200 miles. You can feel that, come to have a perception of the economic movements of the planets or the weather around you. We've experimented with scraping Twitter and plugging you directly into the social consciousness of the planet. We are experimenting with airplane pilots so that instead of looking at a million gauges in their cockpit, they're feeling it all. They're, you know, and so the way I describe this is that it's, you know, this is difference between having access to big data and experiencing big data. So that's what we're working on now.
When it comes to Twitter, what does it feel like? What is a punch in the stomach or something? How does that kind of... Well, what does Twitter feel like? Tell me, what does Twitter feel like?
So the way we set this up, this version is quite simple. It's just that we scrape Twitter for a particular hashtag that people are talking about, and we do an automated sentiment analysis. So we're looking at whether people are using positive, negative, or neutral words when they're talking about this. And this is something where we can scrape hundreds or thousands each second. And then what I'm feeling on the vest is just sort of the amount of good or the amount of bad and the amount of neutral. And so in real time, as I'm giving a talk on something, for example, maybe to thousands of people, then I'm feeling in real time how the talk is going.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. Sticking on this kind of like technological theme, you're interested in brain-machine interfaces as well, so the idea of being able to move something by the power of thought. I mean, what's the future in that? I mean, are you actively in that field yourself now?
I'm not in that field. I'm in the putting sensory information into the brain, but as far as taking motor information out of the brain, the future is already here. So with paralyzed people, their brains are saying to their arm, okay, move, but their arm's not moving. But you can dunk electrodes into the brain, eavesdrop on those signals, and push that through a robotic arm. You can train a robotic arm to say, oh, okay, well, this, she's now meaning to grasp, now she's meaning to reach out, now she's meaning to unflex, and so on. And so there are very beautiful, sophisticated robotic arms that can be controlled just by being plugged directly into the brain now.
There are some pretty large international endeavors going on now looking at the brain. The Human Brain Project is one of them, and that's attracted some criticism about whether or not it's sort of too premature to try to do that, given what we know about the brain. And it might, you know, be taking the wrong approach to sort of looking at the human brain. What do you think we'll gain from it?
Here's my opinion. I think it's not premature. I think it's a wonderful project. The idea is to collect data from all the labs that are doing things and put it all together in a single platform computer simulation. See if you can simulate even a tiny little chunk of a tiny little rat brain. Now, the end goal of the Human Brain Project is to actually run a full emulation of an entire human brain. That's quite a ways off, but I think it's exactly the right path to be on. Often in science, we don't really understand something until we can build it. And once we can build it, first of all, that'll get rid of animal research entirely, because then we can do, you know, make changes in the computer model. The reason it's a long way off before we have a full human brain is because the amount of data that's contained in your brain or mine is about a zettabyte, and that's the entire computational capacity of the planet right now. So it'll be a bit before we get there.
I suppose a sort of final question here is about, you know, artificial intelligence. You're saying there about sort of almost touched on it, but at what point do you expect the sort of boundary between man and machine to actually get blurry?
Yeah, well, I think whole brain emulation will get us there. And, you know, whether it's 50 years off or 100 years is hard to predict, but I think that's when things will start getting blurry, because if you have a simulation of your brain that's running the computer, you can make some changes, make some improvements, and that can start going off in a different direction. The idea of artificial intelligence is the idea that it can't be that hard to figure out what are the building blocks of intelligence. But it turns out that's a deceptively hard problem. And the smartest people on the planet have been trying to answer that for many decades now. And it really hasn't gone anywhere. And I know some people will take umbrage with that statement, and they'll say there's all kinds of AI in our video games and in Google and so on. But it's not anything like the kind of AI that we're all waiting for, where you have C-3PO or the computer HAL or whatever that can have a conversation with you and gets what you're about. That has turned out to be a really hard problem. And I think the new game is looking at what Mother Nature has actually done in the brain, because she's had a long time to run lots of experiments, and she's come up with tricks that we haven't discovered yet. We don't yet know what the algorithms are that are running under the hood that allow us to be the way we are. But what we do know is we have not sort of accidentally discovered those on our own yet.
David's book, The Brain, The Story of You, is published now by Canongate. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to David Eagleman. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. Start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.